Secret Command. On the first evening at 8:30 on the dot, the prisoners were given high doses of drugs by the naval doctor Rickert. The enormous quantity of 50 to 100 milligrams of pure cocaine in pill form, 20 milligrams in chewing gum, or 20 milligrams of Pervitin, also as chewing gum, about 7 times the dosage of the traditional Temler pill. 30 minutes later, the effect set in, and the march on the testing track began, a walk that literally lasted to the end of the night. Between 4 and 5 o'clock in the morning, 7 or 8 hours of tramping in the dark later, most of them gave up because they were footsore. The camp inmate, Odd Nansen, later co-founder of UNICEF, described the experiments. "Just now a singular patrol is marching round and round the parade ground interminably. All are kitted up and sing and whistle as they walk. That's the pill patrol. They're being used to test out a new energy pill. How long can they keep going full steam on it?" After the first 48 hours, it's said that most of them had given up and collapsed, although the theory is that after taking this pill, one can perform the impossible. No doubt the Germans could use a pill like that now. Rickert's notes do not mention the abuse that the inmates were subjected to during this torture. Experimental subject number 3, the 23-year-old Günter Lehmann, was the only one still walking the next morning. He had taken 75 milligrams of cocaine and went on performing his lonely rounds, a total of 60 miles without fatigue, as the experimental records cynically put it. At 1 o'clock, he was sent to the barracks to join the others. All the pumped-up inmates waited there until the evening, unable to sleep. At 8 p.m., the drug experiment was repeated. Another sleepless night for the prisoners. Totally blitzed on strong cocaine, on strong crystal meth, in the concentration camp. The next day, at 8 in the evening, there was fresh distribution of medication. The group remained in their room under the same conditions. The men played cards, talked, read. Some of them lay down, dozed off momentarily, then woke up again. The following day, Rickert described their appearance. Numbers 1, 10, and 11 look sleepy in the morning. Number 9 well rested. The others do not seem affected. They continue about their business as before. 7:30, medication administered once more. On the fourth day, at 4 in the afternoon, the experiment was ended, and the forced participants staggered back to their barracks. Meanwhile, a second group had to begin their march carrying heavy bags, forming a new pill patrol. These prisoners had been given Lehmann's performance as a standard. The threat was that if they gave up sooner than he did, they might face death. Consequently, almost all of them covered the 60 miles required. The naval staff doctor noted with satisfaction, "On this medication, state of mind and will are largely eliminated. The experimental subjects have clearly been forced into a state contradicting their predispositions." In spite of their exhaustion and their weak constitutions, the camp inmates were mutating into marching machines. Such results pleased Admiral Heer, as he could not assume that his soldiers would by natural means drum up the necessary strength and motivation for the futile final battle. But which doses had proved to be best? Rickert, once again, "The goal of keeping people awake and efficient for days and nights without or with only minimal sleep lies within the realm of possibility with the application of substances A to D. Substances B and C take priority. B and C were cocaine salt and cocaine base, each 20 milligrams in chewing gum. Consequently, Rickert's decision was that the young Marines should plow their way through the final waves of the war while chewing cocaine gum for 4 sleepless days and nights per mission. As pointless and inhuman as these experiments were, the Navy doctor seemed to have enjoyed his business trip. He even planned further tests. These were to examine how the capacity for concentration in the course of such sleepless days and nights reacts under the effects of medication. Due to time constraints, or perhaps because the Allies were advancing steadily further, these follow-up experiments were never carried out. There were no members of the Navy Medical Service among the accused at the doctor's trials in Nuremberg. Even after the war, they always claimed never to have had anything to do with the SS, but that is not the case. The quest for so-called performance-enhancing drugs, which had begun at the Military Medical Academy with Ranke, had perverted into enacting experiments on human beings at concentration camps authorized by the German Navy. Going under. On December 7, 1944, Dönitz stood in Dresden in front of 5,000 members of the Hitler Youth. Most in the crowd were only teenagers, 15 or 16, and there were even 10 to 12-year-olds. On the podium, beside the microphone, a mini U-boat had been positioned, looking like a large-scale urn decorated with garlands of flowers. The Grand Admiral was hailing it as Germany's only hope of a final victory. The intention of his speech was to recruit volunteers. Countless members of the Hitler Youth signed up, and over the next few days were driven in trucks with blacked-out license plates to the ports where they were to be deployed. Only there were they given uniforms for these top-secret missions. Obviously, these young men didn't know what awaited them when they pulled on their caps, each with a little gold sawfish stitched onto it, and clambered aboard the hastily riveted-together torpedo vehicles and received their just-as-hastily-pressed pills or cocaine-spiked chewing gum. Soon most of them would drown, wretchedly, like kittens in a sack. Senior midshipman Heinz Mante described a training voyage on the Seehund in which he and his leading engineer were given pep pills whose contents they could only guess at. We felt somehow elated and almost weightless. Everything appeared in improbable colors. Soon oral hallucinations set in, and Mante and his fellow pilot thought they were hearing otherworldly music. The fittings in the boat began to glow and changed shape and size in front of their eyes. But there was more to the experience than just pleasant visions. The effect grew stronger and stronger until it became frightening. Confused, they rose to the surface and meandered around for hours. They were completely unable to remember their course later on. This zonked odyssey was not a one-off case. One midshipman reported that the pep pills were doled out very generously. He himself never ran out. Another Seehund pilot confirmed that at the start of the mission he had been given 5 small red pastilles with the instruction to take them one at a time in the event of fatigue. Knowing nothing about the effects and possible side effects, he took all the doses prophylactically within 2 hours. As a result, he stayed awake for 4 consecutive days and nights. Another pilot described his mission in detail. In January 1945, it was his task to establish whether the Thames estuary was suitable as an area of operations for missions lasting 5 days and 4 nights. Everything in his diving boat was crammed in so tightly that he could barely squeeze himself through the gap. And then there was the high dosage. It was frightening. His seat was adjusted, he was strapped in, surrounded by defective technology and hastily cobbled together apparatus, cut off from contact with the outside world, inexperienced in navigation, alone on the high seas with a lot of drugs in his blood, in a metal box full of explosives. It is not a surprise that he didn't ever arrive at the Thames estuary. Others completely lost control of the situation. The drug took hold of one midshipman, and the constant rocking immediately affected his bowels. Meanwhile, the unchanging rhythm kept pumping from the engines like a heartbeat. When he had to take a pee, he did it sitting down right into the bilge, where his turkey breast snack lay spoiling in the oily water. I had never been seasick, but now I threw my guts up and kept on spewing. It wasn't seasickness, it was sickness, and the temptation just to let everything go became stronger and stronger. We had now spent 2 days without proper sleep. I was sweating in spite of the cold. All that sitting was grueling. Rocking, stench, noise, damp. The Navy's doped-up small battle units stood in for the last remains of a once-feared army that wanted to conquer the world. As late as April 1945, Seehunter were still setting off. One commander stated that he had taken several tablets even before the launch. On the high sea, he saw houses and streets appearing in front of him. Suddenly, I had the feeling that a crow was trying to hack away at the back of my neck. I jerked my head around and looked into the grinning engines of a Lockheed Lightning that was speeding toward us. At the same moment, 2 black dots came away from the body of the plane. He and his engineer somehow escaped unharmed. From the 5th until the 7th day of their mission, they each took between 15 and 20 tablets per day. a sorry record. When their mini-U-boat reached the base at Imuiden, where the partially destroyed cranes of the docks stood out against the low sky, the men tied a white towel to the periscope and sat down with their arms round each other on the edge of the turret. They surrendered, regardless of whom they were surrendering to, regardless of what happened to them. 7 days without sleep were over at last. The Reich didn't only collapse in the dense claustrophobia of the Führer's bunker in Berlin. It also went into terminal decline in the freezing waves of the North Atlantic, while its navy was chemically pumped up on cocaine chewing gum tested on concentration camp inmates. There the mini-submarines bobbed, dived, and drifted, and jammed inside them were the young torpedo fodder of the navy, on the hardest drugs that soldiers have ever taken. Helmut Heyer, the admiral responsible, commented on the missions on April 3, 1945, in a radio address delivered at 2:48 p.m. Situation reports showed that Fighting Group did and risked everything in full deployment to fulfill the mission task. In spite of an uncertain situation at the front and unverifiable rumors, the troop marched onward against the returning tide. Again, it has been proven that there is still a way if the Führer and the troops are cast from the same mold. If immediate success eluded us, there still remains the achievement of which we may be proud. Perhaps the Führer and the troops were cast from the same mold. They were at least taking similarly powerful substances. Heyer's assertion that the pilots climbed enthusiastically into their doomed vehicles was pure cynicism. These involuntary, spaced-out men certainly didn't want to belong to a fighting elite anymore. What happened here was that their last reserves had just been chemically unlocked. Heyer survived the war. Throughout his life he remained associated with the German armed forces, and in 1961 he became ombudsman to the military within the CDU-led federal government under Chancellor Konrad Adenauer. His soldiers, embroidered gold sawfishes on their caps, still lie in their steel coffins at the bottom of the sea. Brainwashing. After his arrest by the Americans, SS Hauptsturmführer Dr. Kurt Plüttner of Leipzig University was described as having a strong physique, a round head shape, mid-blonde hair, blue eyes. He had horn-rimmed glasses, was short-sighted, with full cheeks, beardless, sword scar on the left temple, phlegmatic type. In Dachau concentration camp, as department head of the Institute of Practical Military Research, he had tested chemical methods for the abrogation of the will. They were based on experiments undertaken in the Auschwitz extermination camp by Dr. Bruno Weber, the director of the Hygienic Bacteriological Research Center in Auschwitz, with barbiturates, morphine derivatives, and mescaline. These experiments were inspired by the Gestapo, where there was frustration at their limited success in gaining information from imprisoned Polish resistance fighters. Unlike Sachsenhausen, which was chiefly concerned with endurance tests, Auschwitz was focused on brainwashing and consciousness control. Plüttner continued this barbaric series of tests in Dachau and gave unwitting prisoners mescaline, a psychoactive alkaloid that occurs naturally in the Mexican peyote cactus. The substance, which has been used for thousands of years in rituals by America's indigenous cultures to commune with ancestors and gods, can cause powerful hallucinations. In the 1920s, mescaline was popular among thinkers, artists, and psychologists, as it supposedly expands consciousness. Aldous Huxley would describe the effect in his book The Doors of Perception. But the development of the effect of a drug is always dependent on the circumstances under which it is taken. Plüttner did not intend to liberate his guinea pig's thoughts with mescaline, quite the contrary. Like his predecessor, Dr. Weber, in Auschwitz, he wanted to find out whether better results could be achieved through brainwashing in interrogations. All questioning is a forcible intrusion. When used as an instrument of power, it is like a knife cutting into the flesh of the victim, Elias Canetti wrote in Crowds and Power. If a person's freedom relies largely on the protection of personal secrets, Plüttner attempted to develop a particularly sharp blade to penetrate deep into the hidden heart of the individual. For a test group of 30 people, the perverted SS shaman, secretly dissolved mescaline in coffee or alcohol and began an innocuous conversation with the unsuspecting test subjects. After 30 to 60 minutes, a change took place. The alkaloid had passed into the bloodstream via the mucous membrane of the stomach. The experimental subjects who were opened up by the drug were now informed that in this special zone where the interrogation was taking place, Blüttner had direct access to their soul. He suggested they should tell him everything of their own free will, or something terrible would happen. The perfidious strategy worked. When the mescaline took effect, the investigating person could extract even the most intimate secrets from the prisoner if the questions were asked skillfully. They even reported voluntarily on erotic and sexual matters. Mental reservations ceased to exist. Emotions of hatred and revenge could always be brought to light. Tricky questions were not seen through, so that an assumption of guilt could easily be produced from the answer. Blüttner could not finish his series of tests. The Americans liberated the camp and confiscated his documents. It was a treasure trove for the U.S. Secret Service. Under the leadership of Charles Savage and the Harvard medic Henry K. Beecher, the experiments were continued under the codename Project Chatter and other rubrics at the Naval Medical Research Institute in Washington, D.C. These were used as a matrix for extensive series of investigations that spanned the whole of the 1950s, involved thousands of human guinea pigs, and whose results would be used by the Americans to try to unmask Soviet spies in the Korean War. Like the Germans, they were concerned with becoming precisely acquainted with the way in which these drugs took effect as a practical instrument for their possible use on civilian and military prisoners. Just as the victorious United States appropriated the Third Reich's discoveries in rocket science and the exploration of outer space, the Nazi drug experiments were imported to explore inner worlds. The secret U.S. program MK-Ultra, based on Plötner's initial work, took mind control as its goal. The spelling with a K could be read as a nod to its German origins. Plötner himself was never punished for his crimes, but lived in hiding in North Germany as Herr Schmidt until 1952. In the soccer World Cup year of 1954, the medical faculty of Freiburg University appointed him as an extraordinary professor. Twilight of the Drugs. The higher a man rises, the more he has to be able to abstain. If a street sweeper is unwilling to sacrifice his tobacco or his beer, then I think, very well, my good man, that's precisely why you're a street sweeper and not one of the ruling personalities of the state. Adolf Hitler. The first American convoy entered the conquered port of Antwerp on November 28, 1944. Allied supply routes were in this way secured. In December, U.S. troops advanced on a broad front from the west toward the border of the Reich. Morell wrote on December 9, 1944, about his visit to Hitler. Wanted to do without injection, but then on request, because of imminent major efforts, 10 cc glucose plus homoceran, 10 cc intramuscular. On the following night, Eucadol was also injected into the vein. During that winter, those major efforts were multiplying to an alarming extent. Hitler, self-stylizing himself as a kind of fleshly seismograph for the coming defeat, experienced the most intense levels of stress of his whole life, and the very greatest nervous tensions caused by imminent events and the constant terror attacks on German cities. He repeatedly professed he needed an injection to be able to endure it all. On December 10, 1944, he was traveling toward yet another of the Führer's headquarters, this time called Adlerhorst, Eagle's Eyrie, near Bad Nauheim. From here he planned his illusory blow against the West, the Second Ardennes Offensive. His personal physician noted, "Called 4:30 this morning, Führer having convulsions again. You could all Eupavirine IV. Most exciting day of whole life. A great victory must be won. 11:30 in the morning, Führer still having convulsions and has had no sleep, although big discussions are constantly necessary. Departure dependent on a few important pieces of news that are awaited. Larger injections in the train not possible because of inevitable cold when stepping outside, but in his view, one more big intravenous injection necessary. On December 11th, the desolate luxury train arrived at the new headquarters in the Taunus mountain range near Frankfurt at the crack of dawn. Hitler summoned the commanders of the Western Front, who had for security reasons been divided into two separate groups. Everyone's guns and bags were confiscated, and then the baffled generals were driven back and forth through the bare winter forest to make them lose their bearings. At last they stopped in front of a bunker. The generals walked between rows of black-clad SS men toward a bent figure with a pale, sunken face collapsed on his chair with trembling hands, hiding his left, violently twitching arm to the best of his ability, as General Hasso von Manteuffel described him. The frightening, drooling wreck's name was Adolf Hitler. He had just slurped down two rice gruel soups to give him some strength and acted as if he had the situation under control. He set out a kind of attack plan to the toadying officers, but had to admit that this was a gamble and was disproportionate to our available forces. In Morell's notes, the ghostly meeting is whitewashed thus. Führer had discussion lasting several hours with about 40 to 50 generals. Führer supposed to have been very fresh and lively, inspiring and impulsive. Excellent health. This second Ardennes offensive proceeded quite differently from the first in the spring of 1940. This time it relied on tricks and the hope of bad weather, so that the Allied pilots couldn't bomb the remaining German outposts too easily. SS Obersturmbannführer Skorzeny was operating with 1,000 men in stolen American uniforms with D-9 in their combat packs behind enemy lines to cause confusion. This spread a rumor that they were planning to assassinate the American commander, Dwight D. Eisenhower, and for a short time some U.S. units were actually quite preoccupied by the extra security measures they had to put in place. But the superficiality of the German action soon became apparent. Both the Wehrmacht and Waffen-SS were knocked back amid great losses. On December 19, 1944, Hitler ate spinach soup and then ordered liver and pervitin, requested because of current excessive work. So he was now taking methamphetamine as well. Morell doesn't say whether it was injected or taken orally. The former seems likely, since he mentions it in a single breath with the liver preparation that he always injected. After the war, Ernst Günther Schenck, formerly Himmler's nutrition advisor, claimed that patient A also took the stimulant orally on a regular basis as a clandestine mixture with the Nobel Vitamaltin. He reportedly examined one of the gold-wrapped bars in the Institute for Defense Pharmacy at the Military Medical Academy and presumably discovered that it contained both pervitin and caffeine. The Führer also spent New Year's Eve of 1944-45 in a state of intoxication. First, in combination with glucose, he took a hormone-rich animal liver injection. Then a holiday gift of Eucodol was taken intravenously. Although the dosage level went unrecorded, Morell did record the effect. Führer is almost calm, the trembling in his left arm, or rather his hand, only very slight. As usual, the state of the dictator's health was lauded to the outside world. In the edition of the weekly magazine Das Reich, published on the last day of 1944, Joseph Goebbels wrote, "The man whose goal it was to save his people and furthermore to shape the face of the continent is entirely averted from the everyday joys and bourgeois comforts of life. More than that, in fact, they don't even exist for him. You need only linger in his presence to feel physically how much power he exudes, how strong he is." The propaganda minister also had an explanation for the obviously poor posture of the head of state. "When he holds his head slightly bowed, it comes from studying so many maps. He is modesty personified. If the lunch and dinner tables of our whole nation were laid like that of the Führer, we would not need to be worried about German food supplies." The last large-scale attack by the Luftwaffe ended fatally on the morning of January 1, 1945. Almost 1,000 planes launched for one final gasp. But in spite of strict secrecy, the Allied fighters and anti-aircraft defenses reacted very effectively, and several dozen Luftwaffe pilots turned out to have had their last ever rations of Pervitin. It was on the return flight of the ones who had escaped the enemy that the true disaster happened. The German planes came under heavy fire from their own anti-aircraft gunners, who had not been informed about the mission. In this macabre way, the Luftwaffe destroyed itself against its own cloudy sky. After that, there were no more missions worthy of the name. On January 2, 1945, the first workday of the new year, which was the last year for National Socialism, Hitler felt well apart from the tension of the current offensive. He asked about getting rid of the tremor in his left hand. Tranquilizers needed but cannot be given because they would inhibit his powers of reason, on which the demands are constant and intense and of the greatest importance. This entry represents a turning point, because afterward, Eukerdal was not administered again. Had Morell recognized at last how lost Hitler was in unreal domains? Or did he want to reduce the quantity of drugs for a quite different reason, because he had a new concern, their increasing scarcity? The British were repeatedly bombing the pharmaceutical factories of the Reich and causing severe damage to German manufacturing capacities. 2 weeks before Christmas, the manufacturer of Eukerdal and cocaine, the Darmstadt-based Merck Company, was hit. 70% of its facilities were in ruins. One employee reported, "During this time, the bulk of the workforce, 2,292 Germans and about 700 foreigners, were busy trying to bring order to the chaos of destruction. Productivity was, taken overall, extraordinarily low, as almost two-thirds of working time was lost to air raids." Could it be that Morell's supplies had run out, and there were no more on the way? On January 16, 1945, the Eagles Eyrie was evacuated. The second Ardennes offensive had failed pitifully. Dispirited, patient and doctor took the train to the capital, retreated along with the Führer's inner circle into the bunker beneath the Reich Chancellery, and thus reached the final stage in their denial of reality. Once Morell had complained in a letter that he had only been in Berlin for a few days over the past few years and hadn't seen his wife for 6 months, now he was back on the Havel and the Spree, but buried away under the ground like a mole. On January 17, 1945, a day after their arrival, Warsaw was seized by the Red Army. Stalin's troops were advancing inexorably. Last Exit Bunker. On January 30, 1945, exactly 12 years after the National Socialists first seized power, the Red Army created a bridgehead west of the Oder and directly threatened Berlin. At the briefing session on the same day, which was followed by his final radio address, Hitler appeared in a euphoric mood once again. On February 3, 1945, 2,264 tons of bombs fell on the Reich capital. Thousands of people died. The U-Bahn was hit in 50 places at once. A packed overground train was struck just as it was leaving Belle Alliance Platz, now Hallesche Tor. The sky had a blood-red glow. The survivors hurried through dense palls of smoke. At Schlesisches Tor, another underground station, a big banner hung for a few hours. "We want peace one way or the other." The Military Medical Academy on Invalidenstrasse, where Otto Ranke had once researched, now stood with charred roof beams, empty window frames, and bomb craters on the sports ground. The remains of the walls still smoked. The sirens wailed constantly, the anti-aircraft guns fired, the hellish dance constantly renewed itself, and people lay in slit trenches. 11 days later, the center of Dresden, where hundreds of thousands of refugees were huddled, was flattened from the air. Meanwhile, the drug depot in the Führer's bunker was emptying. At least this could be a possible explanation of why Morell's notes ceased to mention the formerly beloved substances. On February 18th, he wrote, "F wants to try and get by without tranquilizers." Apart from a few ampules of his home-brewed parasite liver preparation, there now seemed to be hardly anything left. The symptoms that Hitler showed during those weeks indicate withdrawal. The tremors were getting worse, and his body was going into rapid decline. At his final speech to the district leaders on February 24, 1945, he had finally lost his power of suggestion. He made a pitiful impression on his visitors, stood bowed, drooling. His announcements about the Navy's new miracle weapon, Haya's small battle units, which would bring about the great miracle of a turn in the war's fortunes, now fell on deaf ears. The same day, Morell wrote to the Reich Ministry of the Interior with a request for the release of new steroids made to his own recipe, two adrenal gland and pituitary gland preparations. This wildly unreal request did not receive a reply. One possible reason for Morell's urging was that since there were hardly any pharmaceuticals left in the whole of Berlin, he was finding it increasingly difficult to honor prescriptions for patient A. His assistants scoured the rubble-strewn city. It could only be processed and filled in the 6th pharmacy, first at Zo, where it was prepared for collection tomorrow. Medication is very hard to get hold of, even for the main medical depot of the SS main office. Most are discontinuing supplies because the factories have been bombed out. The worst thing that could happen to a dealer happened to Morell. His source had run dry. It is the cardinal sin of the provider to suddenly be out of the product. For 4 to 5 days, the patient has been extremely pensive and has a weary, exhausted appearance. He wants to try and manage without tranquilizers, said Morell, commenting on the shortage, and added with a note of concern, The Führer is acting rather strangely toward me, short and in an irritable mood. None of this is proof, yet it is a set of clues that suggest that in the last quarter of 1944, Hitler had become addicted to Eucodol and now yearned for the narcotic. It was unlikely he voiced such a wish aloud or explicitly in those final weeks in the bunker of the Reich Chancellery, but the signs indicate that he was gradually understanding what he had allowed to happen to him, and what a pharmacological blind alley he had ended up in. The end of the final battle was approaching, and Hitler had lost his high, his Führer's rush, once and for all. He dragged himself painfully along the low passageways of the catacombs, thrust his torso forward, pulled his legs after him, tipped to the right, supported himself on the bare wall, and shuffled back from sitting room to conference room. All his energy for self-stylization had gone. Whatever the reason for his abstinence from Eucodol, without the drug, all that was left behind was a shell of a man whose uniform was spattered with rice gruel. Without the substances to which his body had become accustomed, his system ceased producing endorphins. His dopamine and serotonin balance suffered along with his sympathetic nervous system. There was no feeling of well-being now, no protection against the menacing outside world. All that remained was oversensitivity. The concrete walls might still have been standing, but the chemical bunker had been dissolved. Now the Führer had irrevocably entered the reality of his lost war. Everything weighed on him all of a sudden, and as an infinitely heavier burden than before, naked as he was without the hormones of happiness. Eucodol could have helped him now. In a second he would move from total pain to total paradise and experience the most powerful emotions. Euphoria would flood through him. He could regain his faith and motivate everyone else to emerge victorious from the war. But Eucodol no longer existed for him, and without intoxication, the last briefing sessions in March and April 1945 were so depressing as to be terrible. The generals seemed to be trying to hoodwink him all the time. The thing that could never have happened was happening. History was repeating itself. The military had stopped obeying their supreme commander, and he constantly thought he was being sabotaged. Hitler started shouting, waving his arms around, raging, raving, his face so distorted that it was barely recognizable. It was only through aggression that he could defend himself against the traitors he sensed everywhere. Goebbels, who now barely left his boss's side, openly addressed this decay and certified that Hitler was not in the condition that he should have been. Meanwhile, the propaganda minister was highly critical of Morell's methods of treatment. Hitler's body was shaking and had been doped repeatedly with all manner of pills and narcotics. On several occasions, Goebbels noted, he had wondered whether the prophylactic injections, which should have been trying to prevent every illness as soon as the first symptoms appeared, were not in fact making too big a demand on Hitler's health and his life. At 6 o'clock in the morning after the military briefing, during which he had fumbled ceaselessly with his empty pillbox. Patient A lay completely exhausted and apathetic on a small sofa, filled only with the single thought that the best meal of the day was on its way. A mug of hot chocolate and cakes, 3 plates full of them. Sugar was the final drug. 1 more minute release of dopamine. 1 more small reward for the soul. Those bright blue eyes, once so hypnotic, were now dull. Crumbs stuck to his purple lips. A sweet-eating human ruin wrapped in slack skin. His body felt numb, as if he were no longer present in it. His temperature was always high. Every so often he'd go into the oxygen tent. The sight of Hitler now only caused revulsion, or at best pity. Everyone circled around him, trying in vain to make him feel good. Still, his condition kept deteriorating. In the past, all his loyal followers had been nervous at the first cough or sniffle. Now his tooth enamel was decaying, his gums were drying up, and his ruinous teeth were falling out. His brain, irreversibly damaged by neurotoxins, was no longer receiving stimulation. All the receptors that the transmitters could have filled were switched off. Everything had stopped working. The old delusory loops were just repeating themselves in his head. The paranoia, the panic about the red pustules, about the Jews, the Bolsheviks, the whiskey drinker Churchill. Terrible headaches set in. He started digging into his yellow skin with a pair of golden tweezers, with aggressive nervous movements, to get rid of the bacteria that had presumably passed through his body's boundaries and entered his system, and were now destroying him from within. Morell wanted to try bloodletting to bring the patient some kind of relief, but because of the fatty, hormone-saturated pig's liver injections, his blood had become as thick as jelly and clotted immediately, so the measure failed. Hitler, with one last trace of gallows humor, suggested that they might at least be able to make Führer blood sausage out of it. Patient A wheezed pitifully as he endured his withdrawal. He trembled with anxiety from head to toe. He chewed the air. He lost weight. His kidneys were failing, and so too was his circulation. He could barely concentrate now. He was tormented by a painful yearning, an unquenchable thirst from each cell of his body. His left upper eyelid was so swollen that he couldn't see out of his left eye, and he kept pressing and rubbing at it. But the Führer does not want to wear an eye patch. He only left the bunker for a short time, venturing into the garden of the Reich Chancellery, where he stumbled over rubble and the dusty wind circled him like the cloak of defeat. He dragged himself back inside. There was Streuselkuchen, each piece specially crumbled for him. Without a functioning set of teeth, he slurped up the sweets, too much air entering his gut as he did so. Everyone in his entourage threw something into the Führer machine that they themselves had bred, that they themselves had developed. The broken robot rattled once more, issued a pointless military order, avenged himself on someone, or passed death sentences on close colleagues like Karl Brandt, his former surgeon who had fallen into disfavor in the war between the doctors. The historian Sebastian Hafner is mistaken when he describes the reports of Hitler's physical decay in the bunker beneath the Reich Chancellery as hopelessly overdrawn. In fact, they are not precise or far-reaching enough, because they do not take sufficiently into account the possible moment of withdrawal. It is difficult to produce a diagnosis at this distance in time, given the incomplete nature of the material. It is as if Hitler were less concerned with the loss of the World War than with the physical torments that he himself was going through, and which would not stop until his suicide. At this point, the potentate still stood by his personal physician. When, on March 3, 1945, he undertook one last journey to the front at the Oder River, 30 miles east of Berlin, he forbade Morell to come with him for safety reasons. The physician noted, not without some pride, because we might have suffered serious injuries through accidents and low-flying planes. If something happened to me, he would not have a doctor. It was far more important to him while he was traveling that he would always find me at home, waiting for him. But how long would that home still exist? On March 7th, the Americans crossed the bridge at Remagen, and thus the Rhine. In the east, Danzig fell to the Russians. likewise Vienna to the south. At this point, Morel was treating Hitler more or less at random, administering vitamins and galvanic treatments against general nerve damage. The Führer, who had characteristically never gone near any of Berlin's great specialist clinics like the Charité Hospital, now presented an utterly squalid image, which helps to explain his last great destructive experiment. On March 19, 1945, he issued the so-called Nero Decree, which took his nihilism to the limit. Hitler ordered nothing less than the complete destruction of Germany. All military transport and communication facilities, industrial establishments, and supply depots, as well as anything else of value within Reich territory, are to be destroyed. All locks, weirs, dams, canal bridges, and harbor facilities were to be blown up. All electric cables pulled up. All banks and any remaining cultural monuments were to be leveled. Because of a lack of resources, this final product of his hatred was never fully realized. The German Reich's destructive powers were finally spent, and the supplies in Hitler's medicine cabinet were similarly exhausted. On April 8th, Morel informed his patient that there were no more Vitamalten bars left. The supplies that still existed were now injected. Obscure substances such as strophantose 1 and 2, Benerva Forte, Betabion Forte, Omnidin, hastily requisitioned remnants. Substances hardly anyone had heard of were suddenly injected every 2 days. In the late phase of the war, these drugs were thrown onto the chemical front in the same way as the 14-year-olds who had just been sitting at their school desks were now manning the flak. On April 16, 1945, the direct assault on Berlin began. 4 days later, patient A celebrated his last birthday. Morel's hands were shaking, and he had a blackout when he was trying to give Hitler his birthday injection. Attending physician Stumpfegger was summoned and applied everything the drug cabinet still had to offer. Strophantose, Betabion Forte IV, plus Harmin, the latter an alkaloid made from Syrian rue. Together with this, Morel added rather desperately, "I replaced the heart capsules with liver, which is intended to achieve a highly stimulating effect." The Dismissal. "I will leave all the men of history behind me. I want to be the greatest, even if the whole German people perishes in the process." Adolf Hitler to Theodor Morel. The next day, while the Russians shelled the city center with their Stalin organs, Hitler's personal physician was sacked. What was the point of a dealer who was out of stuff and in such poor shape that he couldn't even give an injection? "Do you think me a fool?" Hitler yelled at the dumbfounded Morel, who was paying him a visit carrying a tray with a caffeine injection that he'd managed to drum up from somewhere. "You probably want to give me morphine," Hitler raged. When Morel protested, his patient grabbed him by the collar and spat, "Go home, take off your uniform, and act as if you've never seen me." Crazy advice, because Morel's villa at the Havel River had been bombed out. The windows of his practice on the Kurfürstendamm were nailed up with cardboard. The partition wall in the waiting room had collapsed. With almost comical haste, the plump doctor, after briefly collapsing at Hitler's feet when Hitler threatened to have him shot, left the bunker and climbed the 37 steps to ground level. Panting and clutching his heart, he threw himself into the last available official vehicle and wept like a child. A Condor plane took off at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, with the distraught doctor inside. Flying low over Russian lines and burning villages, the pilot braved searchlights and anti-aircraft fire to cross the American line at Partenkirchen, and after a considerable amount of searching about, landed on a still usable runway at Neubiberg Military Airport, south of Munich. Morel's destination was the little town of Bayerische Gemein near Berchtesgaden, to which he had evacuated his research laboratory. For a few days there, he acted as if all was somehow well, frantically immersed himself in his correspondence, attended to his collapsing pharmaceutical business, tried to operate his half-assembled electron microscope, a present from Hitler, and spoke with his last remaining employee, probably already in a state of quasi-insanity, he asked the revenue office for a deadline extension on his profit, corporation, and business tax declaration. Since due to staff difficulties, we are unable to deliver our final version any sooner. The final poison. I'm not doing politics anymore. It repels me so much. Adolf Hitler. Goering, too, in a ridiculous camouflage uniform bursting at the seams, had fled to southern Germany. If he had to fall into anyone's hands, he wanted it to be the Americans, not the Soviets. Referring to Hitler's inability to act, he sent a telegram from Bavaria to the bunker, emphasizing his ambitions to become Hitler's successor. Hitler raged about his deputy, accusing him of weakness and betrayal. He had known for a long time, he said, that Goering was a morphine addict, and stripped him of all positions and offices. On April 27th, Hitler gave his followers potassium cyanide, regretting in a broken voice that he could not offer them anything better. Goebbels's wife, Magda, gave 6 of the capsules to her children. Patient A had his dog, Blondie, poisoned as a test. He didn't yet lay a hand upon himself. In his political testament, which he could barely sign because his hands were shaking so much, while dying of his own toxins, he raged one last time against the Jews. He tried to blame them for everything and described them as the poisoners of the world. Meanwhile, methamphetamine was being handed out to kid soldiers in front of the Olympic Stadium to keep them from going haywire at the sight of the advancing tanks and heavy artillery of the Red Army. As his morning gift, Grand Admiral Dönitz had sent a declaration of loyalty to his Führer, along with a Berlin-bound cargo of fresh recruits, destined for an early death as they had never even been trained for urban fighting. In the center of the city, the bunker became the focus of the battles that were closing in on every side. There were explosions or implosions on every corner. Walls shook under the impacts. In the garden of the Reich Chancellery, where Hitler no longer ventured for a breath of fresh air, the soil was hurled incessantly into the air. Everywhere around, buildings burned and collapsed, while a firestorm sucked flames and smoke and oxygen upward. The place where this downfall occurred was far from silent. It was an inferno, the end of a terrible journey, a phase of madness that had lasted for 12 years, in which men had been afraid of reality, had tried to flee it more and more, and in the process had brought the most terrible nightmares to fruition. During those final hours, Hitler was devoured by his imaginary bacilli. Throughout the whole of his life, he had tried to eliminate them, but it hadn't worked. Now he planned a double suicide. He had engaged in intense discussions about the problem with his closest circle. What if his hand shook too much when he pulled the trigger? The man who had brought about so many terrible things would now escape responsibility, and because there was no Eucadol left for a golden shot, he opted for the bullet. Only the pistol is stronger than the needle. He hastily married Eva Braun, who had traveled to the besieged city, as Hitler dramatically described it in his personal testament. After the ghostly wedding ceremony, spaghetti was served, with tomato sauce on the side, hydrogen cyanide for dessert, and a bullet in the brain from a 6.35mm Walther. On April 30th, 1945, at about 3:30 p.m., patient A perished from his own system of repressed reality, overdosing on his own poisonous mixture. His bid to make the world rise up in a state of total intoxication was condemned to failure from the outset. Germany, land of drugs, of escapism, and world weariness, had been looking for a super junkie, and it had found him in its darkest hour, in Adolf Hitler. Morell's implosion. When Hitler's suicide became public, obedient compatriots followed his example all over the Reich. Honor demanded it, or the fear of consequences. In the city of Neubrandenburg, for example, there were over 600 spontaneous suicides. In the little town of Neustrelitz, 681. Over 100,000 in Germany as a whole. 35 army generals, 6 Luftwaffe generals, 8 navy admirals, 13 Waffen-SS generals, 5 police generals, 11 of the 43 Gauleiter, leading heads of the Gestapo and of the Reich Security Main Office, some senior SS and police leaders. They all fled reality, following their Führer one last time. On May 8, 1945, the Wehrmacht surrendered. Some of the drugged-up underwater combatants from Heer's Kaiserbande weren't aware of this, and Heer's kites went on fighting for another 4 days and nights until May 12th in a war that had ceased to exist. In mid-May 1945, Theo Morel was tracked down by a New York Times reporter, Tanya Long, to his hiding place in Bavaria. Her article appeared a few days later under the headline, "Doctor Describes Hitler Injections." Shortly afterward, the former personal physician was taken prisoner by the Americans in Bad Reichenhall and remained there for almost 2 years. In his many interrogation sessions, Morel spoke incoherently, frequently contradicting himself, and sank into long silences and deep depression. Everything he had built up, his one-man pharmaceutical empire, was destroyed. Unlike many others, Morel did not make the transition into a new age. His questioners learned little about Hitler. They couldn't even bring accusations of war crimes against the completely feeble doctor who sat apathetically in his cell and experienced episodes of paranoia in which he thought Himmler was after him as he had been during the doctor's war. At any rate, he was no use as a witness for the Nuremberg trials. Apart from, "I wish I wasn't me," barely a single coherent sentence issued from his mouth. So the Americans dismissed the bulky doctor with the Dickey heart in the early summer of 1947 and dropped him off outside the central station in Munich. Morel cowered there, the once powerful man with the gold rods of Asclepius on his collar, now in a worn-out coat, shoeless on the bare cobbles, until a half-Jewish Red Cross nurse took pity on him and put him in a hospital in Tegernsee, where he died on May 26, 1948. This concludes the reading of Blitzed, Drugs in the Third Reich by Norman Ohler. Copyright 2015 by Norman Ohler. Translation copyright 2017 by Sean Whiteside. This book was read by Stefan Rudnitsky and directed by Claire Bloom. This unabridged recording was published by special arrangement with Houghton Mifflin Harcourt Publishing Company and was produced in 2017 by Blackstone Audio Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.